everybody on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let me add my thanks to everybody who pitched in to make our fall membership campaign such a big success. We really, really appreciate your listening, your support, and your interest. My guest this morning is Daniel James Brown. He's the author of New York Times' number one best-selling book, The Boys in the Boat. It tells the amazing story of a group of nine young American rowers who, against all odds, triumph at the 1936 Olympics, stealing thunder from Adolf Hitler's Nazi regime and transforming the sport. The Boys in the Boat has been chosen as this year's One Maryland, One Book selection by the Maryland Humanities Council. It's just been published in a Young Readers edition as well. And Daniel James Brown joins me this morning in Studio A. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So of the many, many reasons that I just loved this book, I mean, just this was a gripping, compelling, wonderful read. High among those reasons is the central character, this fellow named Joe Rance, who is one of the boys in the boat. It's an amazing story, given where he grew up, how he grew up in Depression, Pacific Northwest, to become part of this historic team. Tell us about Mr. Rance.
Yeah, Joe Rance was my neighbor, and the book actually all comes out of a conversation I had with him, I guess about 7 years ago now. His daughter invited me down to meet him. He was actually in the last couple months of his life, and he was living under hospice care at her home. And I went down, and I met this elderly gentleman, Joe Rance, and he was quite weak. He was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally. And I sat down, we began to talk, and he started unfolding this story, first about his childhood and adolescence growing up during the Great Depression. And he had a very, very difficult time. He had a very challenging family situation that he had to overcome. He was basically abandoned by his family as a child. And that story really got to me itself.
Yeah, his father and his stepmother basically at age 15 said, "Joe, we're moving, and you're not coming with us."
They basically came home from school one day and found the car packed and the whole family except for him in the car running, and they drove down the road and left him standing in the rain on the porch of this sort of half-finished house that his father had started, and he was on his own from that point on. And it was just, you know, he wound up having to forage in the woods for food and poach salmon out of the Dungeness River and things like that just to survive for a number of years.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. And then I guess by the time he was by his wits and his great fortitude, he gets himself to the University of Washington.
Right.
And in a way, the guys on the boat, the crew, the people he practiced with day in and day out, they sort of became his family.
They really did. And you know, Joe was really looking for a place to fit in. And when he started a crew at the University of Washington in 1933, it took a while for him to fit in because he had become so independent. He tended not to trust other people, and actually rowing is a sport that's all about trust and fitting in. So he struggled for a while. But eventually, by 1936, he and this bunch of boys came together. They trusted each other on a very deep level. And yeah, they wound up going to Berlin and rowing for an Olympic gold medal against a German boat in front of Adolf Hitler. And that was really a transforming experience for all of them, but especially for Joe, who had struggled so hard to find a place and find acceptance. It was just an enormously important thing in his life.
And you mentioned that you met him right at the end of his life.
Yeah.
But what was he like? I'm struck as I learn about him through your book as a young man, as a kid and then a young man, this enormous fortitude. I mean, is this the only word I can think of? And what's his countenance like? What's it like being in the room with him?
You know, that was part of what was amazing. On that first day that I met him, when Judy had me down to her house, Joe was one of the most relentlessly optimistic people that I've ever met. He really preferred to look on the bright side of everything. Even, you know, he was dying when I met him, and he was still focused on what he was going to do later that day or the next day. And that's the way he made it through his whole life, and I think it's how he made it through the very difficult times he had during the Depression. And and later in life too, to some extent. It was really this sort of attitude of optimism. He wasn't bitter. He was treated so badly by his family, and yet he somehow managed to not grow bitter, as I think most of us would be inclined to do. When I talked to him later about how he'd been treated by his stepmother in particular, he just didn't see any point in spending time, giving voice to how she had treated him. He just wanted to move on.
Hate's just, wasted energy.
Exactly.
Interesting. Of course, there are a number of other really fascinating characters in the book. Another is an English guy who also grew up in a sort of hard scrabble situation. His name is George Pocock. You begin each chapter with little sayings from Mr. Pocock. He's the guy who perfected the art of making the shells, the boats.
Exactly. Yeah, George Pocock grew up in Great Britain. He was a masterful shell builder of these racing shells, and he constructed them out of Western red cedar, this beautiful wood, and they're absolutely gorgeous things to see. And he was just the consummate craftsman. But he was also a very good oarsman, and so he became this presence at the University of Washington Shell House in the 1930s. And in many ways, he was a sort of sage-like figure for these boys. He taught them to approach rowing the way he approached the building of his shells, that is, to put their whole heart into it, to take pride in how they rowed every time they went out to row, to approach it as if it were a craft. And that really centered a lot of these boys and gave them a purpose to what they were doing. And so, we put a quote from Pocock at the beginning of every chapter in the book because he was such a presence hanging over these boys and in the shell house. We wanted his sort of spirit to hang over the story. And one way to do that was to put these quotes through the book.
I'm fascinated as well with the coach of the crew team, Alvin Ulbrichtsen. And he talks about finding just the right mix of elements to put together an eight-man group that can make this boat go faster than anybody else. And it's not just strength and endurance and athletic ability. It's a spiritual quest as well, isn't it?
It really is. Bob Ernst, who is the current director of rowing at the University of Washington, told me very emphatically early on in this project, he said, "I would never take the strongest man or the strongest woman in one of my shells, clone that man or woman, and put eight identical rowers in a boat and expect it to do well." Part of what's interesting about crew is it's not just about strength. And a great crew is a crew that is a careful balancing of both physical types and physical abilities on the one hand, but also psychological types and personality traits on the other hand. It takes somebody to fire the boat up. It takes somebody to calm the crew down. It takes various kinds of leadership skills. And what Ulbrichtsen was brilliant at was the sort of alchemy of putting one of these boats together, the mixing and matching that is involved. And that's what he did so successfully in 1936.
Because he talked about the importance of character of each of the individual rowers and then this collective character of the boat. I never would have thought of this before I read your book, that character even played into it.
Oh, it plays it into enormous, enormous role in it. I mean, there are certain character traits that these nine young men really, I think, all shared. They all had a great deal of perseverance. They all had a great deal of resilience. And interestingly, every one of them had an element of humility. Crew is a funny thing because in one hand, you have to be sort of audacious to go out for it. It's a hard sport, particularly at the Olympic level. So you have to have a fairly big ego in that sense. But it really is all about fitting in with other people. So you also have to have the ability to hold that ego back. And coaches sometimes say that great rowers have both big ego and little ego and know when to deploy both of those.
Yeah. You talk about the term that they use in rowing. And again, I'm coming to this book as a person who's never rowed crew, doesn't know anything about it, about the importance of swing.
Yeah.
In my other life, I'm a musician. And I know Count Basie used to talk about when the band really got it right, they found themselves in the pocket.
That's, exactly.
That's what he would call it.
Right.
And these oarsmen have to get in the pocket and get this swing. What do folks mean by swing?
You know, rowers, when they talk about swing, they literally tear up. They get misty-eyed because it's a pretty rare thing. But when everything in a boat, both physically and psychologically, is in perfect alignment, and all the oars are going into the water perfectly and coming out of the water perfectly, there sometimes, and it's a fairly rare thing, there sometimes comes this phenomenon that rowers called swing. And when that happens, the effort, although there's an enormous amount of effort in moving one of these boats, the effort becomes effortless, is the way they talk about it. And I think it's sort of analogous to sort of a second wind when you're running or something like that. It becomes, although you're exerting yourself at a phenomenal level, you don't notice, you don't feel the effort, you just feel the swing of the boat. And as I say, it's something that rowers are just, you know, some say they've only found swing in a boat a few times. Sometimes crews say that they can do it fairly regularly.
An elusive
it is
quest.
Elusive, yes.
Daniel James Brown is my guest. His book is called The Boys in the Boat on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The enormous energy. I mean, we can talk all we want about character and swing and all that stuff, but the enormous energy it takes. I mean, you say at one point that it's like rowing a 10-minute race is like equivalent to playing two basketball games or something. It's amazing how many calories can be expended in the course of this endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a tremendous toll on the body too, frankly. I mean, again, especially at this level, the Olympic level. But when you row, for one thing, you use every muscle in your body, literally from the smallest muscles in your fingertips to feather the oars, all the way up to the biggest muscles in your legs and your back to power the boat forward. And so it takes an enormous amount of energy expended in a very short period of time. A 2,000-meter race takes about 6 minutes. And a rowing coach once said that in those 6 minutes, you will expend the same amount of energy that you would if you had played two NBA basketball games back-to-back done it in 6 minutes.
Yeah, and done it in 6 minutes. It's also amazing. In 1935, you mentioned that the term Dust Bowl entered the lexicon.
Right.
It was quite a difficult time for our country. Rowing and crew was a hugely popular sport. I mean, you talk about these meets where tens of thousands of people, 75,000, 100,000 people showed up to these things.
Yeah.
It's amazing to think of that.
It's hard to get your head around it these days because it's not that way anymore. But yes. And, you know, it wasn't just in Boston, for instance, where rowing's still quite popular, but all over the country, wherever there was water, you'd get 60, 70, 80, 90,000, 100,000 people out on a Saturday afternoon to watch one of these races. Major races were covered live, coast to coast on radio, which was then a brand new medium. A coxswain's sore throat would make headlines in newspapers. It was, it really rivaled college football and baseball for the amount of ink that was spilled in the sports pages covering it. So it was enormously popular as a spectator sport.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating read. And, of course, you speak at length about the geopolitical implications of this team winning in Hitler's Olympics and Hitler's reasons for having the Olympics. And it's just terrific. So enjoy the rest of your time here in Maryland, and thanks so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Daniel James Brown, the book is called The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. It's this year's One Maryland, One Book selection by the Maryland Humanities Council. You can discuss the book today with Daniel James Brown at 11 o'clock at Glen Burnie High School and tonight at the Jernigan Institute at the National Federation of the Blind. That's near Riverside Park in downtown Baltimore. There are many other discussions about the book planned all over the state over the next few months. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll throw you the link for all the details. details and this program reminder, Phoebe Stein, the executive director of the Maryland Humanities Council, hosts Humanities Connection here on WIPR every Thursday afternoon during All Things Considered. Coming up a little later on the program, the great jazz musician Carl Grubbs joins me to talk about his musical tribute to Charm City. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.